Have you ever watched the television program CSI with all the forensic scientists doing all their things? It's truly remarkable and amazing what new science has been able to do. Well, in a moment, our investigative reporter Cheryl Jones joins us with her interview with a forensic scientist who has done all of those things and more. Wait till you hear this interview when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with our investigative reporter, Cheryl Jones. Now, she's been a news anchor person, a meteorologist for the networks, CNN, the Weather Channel. She's worked in multiple television markets in various capacities. I almost hired her during my days in Detroit in 1978. What were you, about 13 years old, Cheryl, as a weathercaster there in Kansas City?
I was only three, George. Get your math right.
Well, you knew how to do weather, that's for sure.
Yes, I did. It was really an interesting time, and I was the first woman to do weather in the Kansas City area, and that came with its own set of really interesting situations, and it was quite an experience, quite successful, and that's where a lot of things started. Here we are now today.
By the way, the guy who did not hire you after I recommended you got fired, just so you know. How about that? So anyways, tell us about this forensic scientist.
Oh, my goodness, George. It's rare to meet someone who spent his entire life learning, investigating, and studying human nature just in order to solve injustices against other human beings, especially in Art Bohannon's case, children. Tonight, we meet this person, Art Bohannon, a forensic scientist, inventor, veteran military police officer, and senior forensic examiner with the Knoxville, Tennessee Police Department for 26 years. He's an author as well. His books include Prince of a Man. It's actually a biographical diary of a forensic detective and the daily notes with some major cases, along with an ongoing historical novel series, and I believe he's on about number 12 by now.
Wow.
His passion for forensics spans decades, though, and his expertise began at the very young age of 14. He had a calling. He was determined to follow it. Law enforcement agencies around the country and world have called upon Bohannon to help solve mysteries, thousands of them, that in many cases, without his assistance and expertise in forensic science using his unique, innovative techniques, those cases would remain unsolved. Unsolved murders, serial killing sprees, jumbo jet crashes, and 9/11, Art was one of the first people called into action to identify human remains at Ground Zero on 9/11, all preceded by a scary premonition. Let's start there with forensics expert Art Bohannon.
Art, you've had such a wide-ranging career in forensic science. Tell me how it began and a little bit about your work through the years.
Well, it began when I read a book about fingerprinting by the local author, John Whitehead. He wrote the FBI story when I was 14 years old, and I said, wow, I want to do that someday. I lived out in the country. We didn't have electricity, didn't have phones at the time, and we finally got phones a year or so later. But there was no technology out there. I mean, there's nothing, very few books written, and nothing is on criminology, not on forensic sciences. And after reading numerous True Detective magazines, I bought it at a local drugstore. I wanted to do that, and I seen an ad for this Institute of Applied Science to do a home study course. And I just had to have that because I had to learn how to do that. And basically taught myself with a mail order course on how to take fingerprints and pictures and record and document crime scenes. And my junior year in high school, the local sheriff found out that I could actually read fingerprints and compare fingerprints. And he brought me into work to scenes. And I had my first case actually at 18 that I testified in court on.
Did you know then that you were going to stay on the pathway of forensic science for the rest of your career?
Oh, it was so exciting. It was so exciting. Yes, I guess I did.
Tell me about your involvement and your work with 9/11. What happened? How did you get involved? And what did you see when you got there?
Well, my 9/11 actually started on 9/9. My wife and I were in Bar Harbor, Maine on a working vacation on a Sunday morning, 4 o'clock. I woke terrified, absolutely chilled to the bone. Something horrible was happening. So we got out of the room by 4:30, started driving south, called the family, called the neighbors, nothing going on. I said, yes, there is too. So September 11th, we were in Winchester, Virginia at the Cracker Barrel. We just finished and came out. My brother called me on the cell phone and said the plane just hit the World Trade Center. And I said, yeah, probably one of those little tour planes. I've been up there before and they fly all over New York City. Just a few minutes, the second call. And then the third call was the deputy commander for the DMORT, which is Disaster Mortuary Operation Response Team, which is a reserve unit under the Public Health Service at the time to respond to disasters. And he said, we're going to New York and come on home. So during the time, Fred had called the six responders from Tennessee, including myself. And we met on the 12th, about 6 or 6:30 behind Berry Funeral Home in Knoxville. And we loaded up and started driving north. So we got there about 10 o'clock at night, and all the responders east of the Mississippi, that was a rendezvous point for all of us. So by 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, 800 of us in a hangar on cots trying to sleep. They finally got lodging in New York City, and we went on down. You know, the closer we got, the worse the odors got. We could see the smoke. We drove right through it. So I was the first out of the whole team to go into the ground zero. Here I get out in the dark with my little flashlight, start walking toward the light. And 2 or 3 blocks up, I seen the morgue on the left. I went from there up to the ground zero. And there's debris everywhere up through there, walking in the dust and all that stuff. And I stopped right at the edge of the rubble. A big crane had a man in a basket and a red dog and slowly going over the rubble trying to find someone living. And beside it was a man on his side watching as it was digging. And all at once, somebody said, stop, stop, stop. And they went scrambling up on that heap, and they saw something. I mean, the lights was really bright, and they had flashlights. And they saluted something in the rubble, and they got down on hands and knees and finally got out part of a human body, still in turnout gear. And they called for a basket. One of the body baskets was sent up. And out of nowhere, a police line was formed. They started passing it back down. And at the bottom, they had a four-wheel gator-type vehicle. And laid the basket on top of that. Somebody yelled attention, and they draped the flag over it. And I noticed the big, strong men and women, I guess, covered with soot and dust. They're crying, streams coming down their face. And I slowly walked behind them back to the temporary morgue where we transferred the remains to a waiting ambulance. And they left wide open with siren and everything going to the medical examiner's office. At that point in time, my face was wet. That was a brother, sister in uniform I'd never met that gave the life tip to somebody else. So that was the beginning of it.
You've put in endless hours up there. How long, Art, did you end up working at Ground Zero?
Well, I actually worked there 10 days at Ground Zero, and I got really bad sick and came home and got better. I worked 7 at night to 7 in the morning. But when I went back, they wanted me to work in a medical examiner's office on the DNA recovery team. And that was 7 in the morning till 7 at night, or when we got completed. If they had members of service coming in, you know, later, we stayed sometime till midnight. So we worked 12 to 18 hour days, 7 days a week. When a member of service was found, that was really a moving event because that person gave their life to try to help somebody else, to save somebody else.
What was your most moving moment there at 9/11? I know you had so many. Is there one that stands out?
Yeah, there was really one when I went back to work at the medical examiner's office on the DNA recovery. We kept looking for any tattoos or anything on the bodies to help narrow the identification down. And they brought part of a body in with the left arm, and he had a tattoo on it. And we were looking for tattoos. We notified the fire department, and they immediately called someone. And they said, cover it up except for the arm. And this firefighter, the son of this man, came in and left and laid his arm down beside his father's arm, and we photographed it. That was his dad.
What physical and emotional effects have you had to deal with as a result of all of that time spent at Ground Zero?
My lung function's low. I was misdiagnosed in 2011 with COPD. I have the reverse of that. I can get air in, but I can't get it back out. So I have COLD, low lung function, Barrett's esophagus, GERD, acid reflux, and just some days that my oxygen level gets low. I just have to chill out and drink cold water until it gets better. There's nothing I can do about it. My arms have been done. There's no way to cure it. So I just have to learn to live with it.
What kind of toxins were you exposed to there?
Dioxin, benzene, aluminum, pulverized aluminum. Both buildings had about 100,000 mercury vapor lights. And, you know, when a mercury vapor light burns or blows, you're supposed to get out. We were breathing all that. Pulverized cement, asbestos, everything nasty you can imagine, we were breathing it.
What about first responders? Did you have any interaction with first responders that sticks in your mind forever?
Well, the anthropologist I work with, it's a medical examiner's office. She looked at all the incoming human remains as anthropologists trying to identify what part of the body was. And when the first tower came down, she went down and she had a near-death experience. She almost got killed when the second one fell. She was that close to it. And she got bruised all over and some broken ribs and she couldn't breathe and both her eyes were black and just beat her up bad. But she survived and came back to work in the medical examiner's office doing what she's supposed to do as the rest of us did.
Every year you have a 9/11. It has to be an emotional event every year, but obviously with time, everything changes. How do you spend your 9/11s every year? And I guess more importantly, how did you spend it this year?
This year was different. It's the 20th anniversary. For some reason it was surreal. And I taught classes, did presentation at high school to about 300 students. And I've done a total of 7 presentations to groups and my journey up there and what we did. And it gets very emotional because, when I look back and think about, you know, those two guys digging down that rubble and bring that part of a first responder out, put him in a basket, take him off. That's when my brothers and sisters had died, giving their life to somebody else.
In looking back at that experience, Art, would you say, even though you'd had so many decades of experience in for the forensics, were you at all prepared for that emotionally?
Not that a massive undertaking, absolutely not. I'd been involved in a total of 8 plane crashes, which included the 2 there, the Discovery spaceship when it came in over Texas, I was there, and 3 commercial airlines to recover human remains for identification.
What about Hurricane Katrina? You worked on that in forensics, and you were called into action to identify victims of that natural disaster. How do you compare the experiences you have in different disasters? Like, for instance, compare what you had to do with Hurricane Katrina to what you had to do with 9/11.
Well, it was completely different. In Katrina, we worked 3 weeks and, you know, a few hundred bodies actually drowned. A few hundred people actually drowned, brought those in. So some of those had the identification on them. They were fresh bodies. We opened 1,200 caskets that had floated out to identify the long dead. And we identified over 90% of the 1,200. And the other was because family didn't come forward to give us information.
You also have had a lot of experience working with the body farm in Knoxville, Tennessee, at the University of Tennessee.
Yes.
For our listeners who don't know anything about the body farm, explain to us where the bodies come from that are used there for research and how are they displayed throughout the farm?
It's a place of honor. It started in 1976. I met Dr. Bass in 1976. We worked lots and lots of cases together, and I actually did 3 different researches at the body farm. And it's just a place of honor. It's about a 3-acre complex behind University of Tennessee Hospital on the University of Tennessee campus. It's fenced in with 2 fences, and people who are dying or think they're going to die soon, then they don't make their body for research. And right now there's a long waiting list. I mean, the overflow of the bodies, and they're sending some on to the Forensic Center in Oak Ridge. And it's just amazing to see the number of people that want their body used to help someone else.
How many bodies are down there at any given time?
I wouldn't have any idea now. I mean, back when I retired 20 years ago, there was always 40 or 50 in there. Some buried, some in water, some in tanks, some in buildings. I mean, every scenario you could think of, because when law enforcement would have a case, they would go back to the body farm and try to recreate that scenario using a real body to see what happened. Now, it's been there so long now, the students they're looking at different things. I mean, rated K and all that's been well documented. What they're looking at now is arthritis in the bones, breaks, something unusual about the skeletal remains. And it's a place of honor. It really is a place of honor to learn.
Strange profession, huh, Cheryl?
Very strange. It takes a very unusual, dedicated, and passionate person about forensics to do everything that he has done. And that's just a sliver of it. It goes much further than what we've had time to discuss.
How did he get involved in all of this?
Well, he said it just was always an intriguing area. No one else around was doing that. He was fascinated by mysteries, the murder mysteries and unsolved crimes. And as he mentioned, he started at a very young age of 14 and in his teens became so good at working with fingerprints that he was called upon by the local sheriff to help them with some cases.
He kind of reminds me of Cyril Wecht, the pathologist, who does a lot of this. Of course, this is a forensic scientist. There's a difference. He's not a doctor. But they love doing what they're doing.
He's fascinated by it, and when he'll talk more about it in our next segment, but he was involved with some local crimes involving children and young girls, and that really, really touched his heart. He couldn't get over what he was seeing and the frustrations involved in really, really finding the fingerprints before they evaporated. That's a whole interesting story about how he managed and how he worked to accomplish what he did in terms of a very unusual device, very innovative, very successful, and patented device that's used worldwide today in solving these crimes.
Does he go worldwide, or is he restricted to a certain area?
But now, because of health and because of retirement and age and the difficulties in traveling, he limits his work now within 100 miles. I just spoke with him earlier today, and we were talking about the current case with Gabby and the
Landry. Laundry, I guess.
And the search for her ex-fiancé. And it's just, he said that's too far away to go. And, obviously after a body has decomposed to a certain extent, there's no fingerprints or anything of that nature. But his fingerprint investigation is phenomenal with identifying and being able to work with latent fingerprints. And that is when the fingerprint of someone else is found on the victim's body.
Has technology made his job easier?
Yes, it has over the years. He mentioned his extensive work with the body farm, and that, of course, has changed over the years. When they first started, it was so many bodies, as he said. And I asked him also, are they still doing that many bodies? He had mentioned that they're doing work with arthritis and health conditions and all of this. There's so many different aspects of the body farm, which is known worldwide. And he said after a while with so many bodies, the ground is contaminated. It's already identified with the bodies that are planted. So they've run out of ground, so to speak, to really continue the work as it has been going on for all these years, the decades, under the founder, Dr. Bill Bass. And it's phenomenal. Other places are starting to pick up where the body farm has transitioned due to all of that and due to the space already having been taken up.
We're coming back with part two with Cheryl Jones in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls next hour with Cheryl Jones, almost in an open lines format, so get ready for that. We'll be back with part two of her discussion with a forensic scientist, and fascinating interview indeed. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with our investigative reporter, Cheryl Jones. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, open lines with Cheryl, and I'll jump in once in a while as well. Cheryl, let's pick up part two of this interview with a very fascinating Arthur Bohannon.
It is fascinating, George. In my upcoming interview here, the second part, we'll find out how Art Bohannon's unconventional discoveries in forensic science using super glue led to solving a serial killing spree that unnerved his home state. He said decades of learning and investigating, a lot of trial and error in so much research. His ingenious technique today provides law enforcement around the world with tools they need to solve crimes and identify bodies, determine whether they're adult or children, and the gender as well. So it's been significant in leading to a federal law to protect children today and used across the country. He's also invented the means to solve a mystery of who might be buried in the grave, some of them centuries old. His premonition of 9/11 came true. He followed that call and became one of the first forensic team responders on the scene at Ground 11. And our listeners, George, will find out that 9/11 isn't the only premonition he experienced. Other premonitions have come true as well. One foreshadowed the untimely death of someone very close to him, his son. And he feels very blessed to be in communication and to live the life he's lived. And what could the communication from the spiritual realm be? Well, a ghostly image appears unexpectedly in a photo Art took in Queens following the crash of Jumbo Jet after 9/11. Let's listen in.
I want you to detail a little bit more about that premonition that you had before 9/11. You told me that you were on vacation a
yes.
couple of days before 9/11.
Yes.
So explain that again to me in a little more detail.
Well, it would have been on the 9th of September on a Sunday morning. We were in Bar Harbor, Maine, and I woke absolutely terrified, chilled to the bone. And we got up and packed real quick and started driving south. I knew something horrible was happening or getting ready to happen, but I didn't know what or the where. And it's just the further south I got closer to home, the more I knew that my premonition was accurate. You know, I thought it was somebody in the family got hurt or a neighbor, and nope, they're all okay. So I knew it had to be something, and if what that something was would change our world forever.
How would you analyze, in looking back at the times that you've had premonitions, do they help you prepare, or maybe has there ever been a situation where you felt that they've helped you prevent something?
In my field of work, maybe not prevent it, but to do a better job at the scene. In 1997, I had a premonition that I'd be working on mummies near huge pyramids. And I said, I'm not going to Egypt. And boy, within 90 days, I was in Guam where Creon 801 crashed in the jungle over there. And when I looked upon the mountain, here was these huge monument-looking things. That was the concrete bunkers the Japanese built during World War II. What I was working on was the bodies brought out, unzipping the body bags. So that was close enough.
You've done so much work in so many different arenas in forensic science, but one area that you've received a lot of attention on has been your area of research and innovative and invention of techniques. What was involved in your work with fingerprints? And explain to me what you did to create a technique using super glue to lift fingerprints, and how is that significant?
Well, I determined there was a problem because we'd had serial murder case in Knoxville where several females had been murdered and dragged across the ditch and into the woods by the arms and legs. And I always felt like there should be fingerprints on their arms and legs where they've been dragged across the ditch and through the woods. There was no process to it. And I contacted the International Association, my friends, the FBI, Scotland Yard, and they all had the same problem. There's no technique to it. And I said, well, you know, maybe I can solve it. So one of the old detectives I worked with said, well, you know, if it could be done, somebody smarter, you would already done it. Well, that didn't discourage me. So I applied for research status at the University of Tennessee Hospital to use research bodies, and I was granted the research. And it took about 2 years to figure out the right process because I used everything the Japanese and Canadians and Scotland Yard had done to try to get prints off the body to enhance what they were doing, and nothing worked. So I turned to super glue and found out the proper amount of super glue vapors on the skin would develop the fingerprint in about 30 seconds. Now, I heat the super glue to 400 degrees. It turns from a liquid to a gas, and you force the gases on the skin in about 30 seconds burst. And then use the black magnetic powder, and it sticks to the super glue print and not the skin.
This technique that you developed is still used around the world today, correct?
It is. Well, my fingerprint technique is used worldwide, and actually the patent I applied for, I got a dual patent, is for apparatus and technique both. So the technique is used around the world.
Tell me about the energy field. What is it that you sense when there's a difference in energy or you're around it? Does it intensify when you're near a grave?
Since you can't create or destroy energy, the moment I die, my spirit goes to paradise, but that energy field goes in the ground with the body. In 2015, in an old veteran cemetery in downtown Dandridge, Tennessee, which is the second oldest town in the state, I was challenged, will we ever know if somebody's actually buried where there's no rock and who's actually where the rock is that doesn't have a name on it? And I was challenged to come up with a solution, and I called my forensic friends, and no one ever thought about something like that. And I meditated on it, and the third morning I woke up, I had to answer that there's actually a energy field that is left in the body after death.
What about identifying adults versus children? Is there any difference regarding the research you've done and the device that you've come up with in terms of identifying the gender and the age?
Well, with 4 years of research, when I determined, yes, there is something, I said, nobody's going to believe me. So I got a emergency room doctor. I got a professor at a college. I got a historian. I got my friend, Steve. And we went into known cemeteries. They'd put towels and cloths over the tombstones, and I'd scan whole rows of them. They would document my reading. Now, I determined that the magnetic field that's either inside or attached to the red blood cells for a female is south. For the male, it's north. And I just made a device that shows me north or south, and I know which one it is based on scanning of 500 marked graves by blind testing with a 99% accuracy rate.
What do you think the impact has been in forensics with the use of your discoveries, both with the identification of the gender and the age, but also with your fingerprint lifting procedure?
I've proved without a doubt it works. I can determine gender and whether it's a child or adult, and I'm pretty close to determine if it's between 8 and 14, you know, when we're changing from the child over to the childbearing years. I'm pretty close to that.
You can distinguish whether it's an adult or a child.
Yes. 99% accuracy rate. And I hold this device over a grave about knee high. In 10 seconds, I can determine male or female, adult or child.
And that's because of the magnetic energy?
Yep. Sure is.
Is that magnetic energy different, significantly so, from a dead body compared to a live body?
I don't get anything from a live body. If something happens in the blood, the magnetic field completely changes from wet blood to dry blood or from life to death.
Art, you've had so many different formats to cover in your forensic science career. What's the oldest grave you have ever investigated?
The oldest that I can date is near Sevierville, an old unmarked Indian mound. I had to scan it twice. I scanned it first and located 12 adult males in a circle in the mound, roughly 16 feet apart. And I got so excited to find them, I had to go back, and I went back and determined that the head is toward the center. So apparently they were facing what was in the center of a totem pole or something. So they either worshiping or honoring something in the center of it. And the last mound builders in this area was 1,000 to 1,200 years ago. So that energy field is still there 1,000 years plus.
Art, how many graves have you investigated using the device that you developed?
I call this the human remains locator, and we have discovered over 3,000 lost graves in the last 5 years. And one that is discovered in a huge cemetery had 410 lost graves. We found one that had a faint response to a male child and a huge response to an adult female. And the best I could determine, based on the position of the grave and where the response is, she probably died in childbirth, and that little boy's laying on her chest. And she'd been dead over 200 years.
What calls do you get the most?
Lost graves. I have one tomorrow to do. A family selling farm, and they have a family cemetery out, so they're moving it to a real marked cemetery. And this man and his sister thought, wait a minute, we had a little brother that died was a stillborn 73 years ago, and daddy brought him home from the hospital, put him in a shoebox, and buried it under a walnut tree in the yard. So they want me to find that. And I said, there's not going to be anything left there but the energy field. And they said, well, will you come and show us where it is and let us determine what we want to do? And I said, I'll be happy. So I'm doing that tomorrow.
I was looking through one of your books, your biography, Prince of a Man. There's one picture in there that looks like a ghostly image.
Right in the middle of the 9/11 process, Veterans Day 2001, Flight 587 went down in Queens, New York. They called me back up to help with that one, and two of the team members wanted pictures taken, and I took two pictures there, and when it was developed, both pictures had ghostly images, and one has a ghostly image. To me, it looks like a small child laying on a table with the legs bent over the side of the table from the knee down. And we worked a lot of children in that crash. I mean, there was 20 or 30 kids on that plane that went down.
Where was that picture taken? At the morgue?
At the medical examiner's office. Uh-huh.
At the medical examiner's office.
Right outside the where we all the remains were brought in from World Trade Center in that crash too. About 12 feet to her left is where the triage table was, where all the bodies were brought in.
I'm looking at that photograph right now. It is very eerie on page 215 of your book, Prince of a Man.
It is on the left side of that ghostly. You can see that baby laying there.
And you told me a very touching story about your son, Ben, giving you help from the other side. Can you recant that for our listeners?
Well, in 2004, early 2004, late 2003, we were going to get two plots for burials where my father, and my mother, and my grandparents were buried in a cemetery. And every time I'd go think about going talk to my cousin and kept the book for the cemetery, I knew I had to have three. And I thought, what in the world? Why do I need three graves for? What do I need three plots for? And it went on. I never went because every time I thought about it, this overbearing voices kept telling me you need three. And then my son was a University of Tennessee police officer, Veterans Day 2004, and he just started on his way home, and a speeding semi hit him head on. And that was the third one I was supposed to get. And that's where he is right now. His body is. His spirit's gone to paradise.
And you told me a very moving story about how you've managed to accept that situation, that he's no longer here in the physical life, but in the spiritual, and the closure that you were able to come to on that situation. Can you tell me about that again?
When I got kind of calmed down after he died, which was the next morning, I asked God the question why, and the answer was immediate. It was his time. And when it's our time, we're going no matter what we are, what we're doing. We may prolong it. I mean, like the crash in Guam, the Korean Air One crash, 29 people survived that crash. It took 3 days to get a road in there to get the people out. And one of the ladies that survived the crash moved to Knoxville and was murdered the next year in Knoxville.
You feel like he's helping you?
Yes.
And you feel like your work is a calling?
It is. I feel I was chosen before birth for what I'm doing now. I've been so blessed, and I keep trying to remember it. And to whom much is given, much is required. And I keep my best trying to give back and help others.
And where can people find out more about your work, your books, and the things that we've talked about tonight, Art?
This, Google my name, Author Bohannon, or Art Bohannon, and see, and they can go find me on Facebook, or they can go to my webpage, is artbohannon.wordpress.com.
Thank you so much, Art. It's been a fascinating conversation. It really has.
It's good to be here.
And George, Art truly feels it's his calling. He's so humble and so thankful for everything that he's had in life. But despite the tragedies he's endured, what he has seen firsthand, that's unbelievable. And the existing health conditions that he's had as a result of working. He actually worked over 8 weeks total at 9/11 and inhaled and worked around all of those toxins. So that's something that anyone who worked there, was there, would understand much better than those of us just looking from the outside looking in. But whether it's helping solve a murder investigation, especially involving children, his technique of using super glue vapor to lift latent fingerprints off a body helped solve the murder of the young girl that actually led to the creation of one of the most used laws involving child crimes. It's called Megan's Law, and that's the federal law that it was enacted following the murder of a very young girl named Megan Kenka in New Jersey years ago in the 90s. And that law requires persons convicted of crimes against children to notify law enforcement officials as to their whereabouts, and requires police to make that information available to the public. So because of Art's work and dedication, that law works to protect children today. And also, I'd like to give an update on the story he mentioned about his recent work with the looking for the grave of the small child and the baby. He talked about the last two living memories of members of an old family farm selling the place, and that they wanted to find their baby brother to locate the baby's grave. and put it next to the parents' grave. So I just spoke with him today, and he said he used the human remains locator that he devised and found the energy field of that baby boy up in White Pine, Tennessee. And now he says that baby boy, the remains, is resting in the cemetery between the graves of his mother and father. Truly amazing.
I don't think I would have the stomach for his kind of job.
I don't think I would either. But it's amazing to me how much he has been through and how much of the work has been hands-on, so detailed and so, you know, just really in touch with everything. That's why I think he developed such a passion. He was intrigued by the whole process, but he was really driven early on by a passion to look for a way to find fingerprints that he knew were there on victims of young children, especially girls, and in finding the killers. In the earlier days, before the technology and before he developed the device that he developed, he found that those fingerprints would evaporate much more quickly from children than adults. And that's how he, through trial and error and using different methods, finally came up with that procedure that was patented. And he gave a prototype of his device to the FBI that was used in solving that Megan's Law case.
Up next, open lines with Cheryl Jones. And let me tell you, she is very proficient in UFOs, ETs, ghosts, you name it. Jump on board next.